Under a bare crescent moon near the dying embers of a fire, a few stalwart folk gather to hear a story. This is no ordinary story, for in the shadow of the old Grant House on Blowing Streams Farm, Wendy Tippins begins to read from Georgiana Katarsky's book, Ghost of the Southern Tennessee Valley. Fibonacci 3 is the band that provided the unusual background sounds to frame the story of the ghost that haunt this farm.
The name of this story is Blades and Roses. I remember riding up that driveway as a child, maybe about 10 years old, says Tom Calvin, about the old Grant House in Blowing Springs at the foot of Lookout Mountain in Chattanooga Valley. He often came along when his father hayed the nearby fields. Tom had plenty of time, the sort children used to spend imagining and speculating. The house had been vacant for who knows how many years, and it looked very spooky. It was a dingy, white, with blacked-out shiny windows of lead-filled glass. From the outside, looking in, it looked black. The reflection was toward you and nothing inward. I wouldn't ride up there, just around the circle, just up to the bottom of it. And at that time, it had a very different vibe to it. But Tom was drawn back to the house almost 20 years later. In 1984, it became his home. It had just been featured by the Chattanooga Symphony as a decorator show house. The renovation awakened the jeu de voix that had filled the house long ago. It had been fully restored back to its gleaming beauty, says Tom. There aren't many rooms in the house, but they're all huge and beautiful. The ceilings are huge, 12 to 13 feet. As he began to work on the house and yard, his curiosity grew about who lived there before him. Looney McCauley, a highly skilled carpenter in North Georgia and Lookout Mountain area, had built the house in 1855 for Colonel J.J. Griffin. Tom learned that a Miss Grant, Miss Leela, he calls her, was born there in 1891. She married Robert Wirt and remained in the house until 1977. Along that walkway that goes down were magnificent wildflowers and all kinds of things that she was very good at growing. She loved fresh flowers, and at times, after she passed away, you could smell the flowers throughout the house, says Tom. It was either magnolia or roses. It was very strong. Miss Leela also had a way with children. She was soothing, so soothing that parents would drop them off, and they weren't crying anymore. They were out helping her with her plants. A tombstone dated in the early 1900s and possibly meant for a child was found in the root cellar. But there was never evidence of a child ghost, Tom says. Miss Leela wouldn't allow such a thing. No doubt, she kept the little spirit at peace with her enchanting ways. Tom knew right away he belonged there. He recalls feeling an inner peace during the years he lived in the house. Miss Leela seemed there still, caring for the house and those within. The house talks to you in a certain way. You could tell there was a presence there. I don't know that anyone has ever put a finger on what it was. The feeling that I got was that it took care of the property. The spirit liked me because I was preserving the place. I never saw anything bad. Instead of having the life scared out of you, it was pretty relaxing, like having life slowed down for a second. Sometimes we called it Tranquility Island. It seemed so peaceful, almost sacred. It attracted you. People would come by all the time and they'd just stay. The longer people stayed, the more comfortable they got. We had people spending the night. It's almost like they'd forgotten all their cares. It seemed to Tom the house conspired to hold people in its protective shadow. It was like breaking out of the magnetic connection there, he explains. For some folks, it was staggering. Many visitors lost their keys or became confused when it was time to leave. One, in his bewilderment, even ran over the flowers. The place had a long history going back to the Cherokees' occupation of the property. Tom says it was harmonious for them as well, but that wasn't so for everyone. The house offered many a young soldier respite from the gruesome feast of blood and death during the dark autumn of 1863. The Yankees took a mighty whipping during the Battle of Chickamauga and fled toward Chattanooga. Although the house was not on the main route out of Chickamauga, 13 miles to the south, some soldiers did pass nearby. Located near the springs just south of the Tennessee line, the home no doubt tempted many a weary soldier to stop and rest. During November 1863, the Yankees struggled to take Lookout Mountain, 5 miles to the north. No battle ensued near the house, but the guns were heard there. The Union used it as a hospital. Injured men could be evacuated there easily through what is now St. Elmo. When they were getting pinned down, trying to get up the mountain, the house was where they were dragging them off to, says Tom. Despite the horrors of those times, Tom thinks Miss Leela turned any bad vibrations around. The house, or the presence within it, repels negative people and attracts artistic ones. According to neighbor Hilda Morse, Miss Leela's mother, Elizabeth Grant, was musically gifted. I'd always been told she'd played for the Chicago Symphony Orchestra, Sam says Hilda. She even composed several pieces, including Kalima Waltz, an original printing of which remains in the Morse family as a treasured memento. Nationally known architect Garnet Chapin later bought and worked in the house, then rented it to musicians, artists, and media types. But being the creative sort was not an automatic foot in the door. One of the most popular DJs in town moved in with Tom and his friends. He didn't have very good luck there. He was a bad vibe type guy, and the house did not like him, says Tom. This radio personality was a real cocky person, really full of himself. One night, the others asked him to leave. He was mad. He said some angry stuff. It was bad. He no more got the thought out of my head. That was a pretty negative thing to say when he turned away from us, lost his footing, and cracked his head. The railing, when he fell, hit him right between the eyes and split his head right open. There was a guy who stole something from us, that part of the house, and he had some really bad luck after that. There was kind of uncanny in the timing. The object that he stole, when he pawned it, got him into trouble for some other stuff. It was like it told on him. Although Tom insists the house contains no evil, he does admit to being just a little rattled by the goings-on there. The front right bedroom gave people a creepy feeling, he says, and the attic, known as Hill's Kitchen, seemed home to a restless entity that traveled up and down the stairway, skipping steps as it went. There'd be a creak in the most unusual place. I heard that several times. It was like someone took a step. On the first step, the center step, the last step, skipping the rest, usually from the top down. Like Tom, musician John Nichols was drawn to the solitary house on the hill and couldn't resist looking toward it when he drove by. I always noticed that house, the long driveway that curved around the big old tree at the end of the stream, the back of the house, he says. There's a lot of energy on that property. A lot of that area is very spiritual, or even sacred. He remembers that famous psychic, Doc Anderson, practiced his art a few hundred feet up the road in a little red and white house. People came to see him from all over the world. Even Elvis was there before his death in 1977. John moved in with Tom and was soon initiated into the mystic life on the hill. One night, John says, I was sitting in Tom's room. It was in the summer, and we were just talking. The leaves were out on the trees and on the side of the house, and the cars would come down Georgia 193 and cast shadows, and I was looking directly out the window, and all of a sudden, this car was coming, and it created this perfect face of a young woman, her hair blowing in the breeze. He asked me what I had seen, and I told him it was something I was supposed to see. The shadow was alive. It was projected there on the wall in a very well-lit room. One night, John and Linda and another tenant were the only people in the house. John was watching television when Linda came in. She seemed a bit edgy and demanded to talk with him. They went to a common area and sat down at a table. Did you go into my room last night? She asked John. No, I would never come into your room unless I asked you. It's none of my business. You're positive. Well, you know me well enough to know I'm not that kind of a person. I would never do that. When I woke up last night, there was someone standing over me, breathing on me. The lights were out in Linda's room. She hadn't seen the entity, but only felt its breath. Well, I'm not surprised, John said. What do you mean? John told her that there were spirits in the house, but it certainly wasn't me. One tenant says Tom saw an image, a man with a long beard and overalls floating above his bed in the front bedroom one night. He thought it resembled Looney McCauley, the carpenter who built the house. But someone less affable than a curious carpenter lurked around the old house. John, a truck driver, as well as a musician, came in one summer night from a routine trip hauling carpet in Dalton. It was almost dark, about 8:30 or so, and the weather was agreeable. He pulled in under a big oak tree in the yard. I looked in the side mirror of my car, and there was a Union soldier. The soldier stood in the side yard, 20 feet from the house, short and stout, maybe in his late 30s. He had dark hair and a full beard. I saw that as plain as day, and I was stone sober. He looked like he was a ranking officer, had a couple of belts across his uniform, a pair of big boots, carrying a long saber or sword. The ghost appeared to look right at John and seemed none too friendly. He had an ugly face on. He was very serious. He had a saber out, swinging it back and forth. John couldn't believe his eyes. I looked back out my window, which was down, and there was nothing there. Several years later, a neighbor down the road saw a soldier with a raised sword inside his house. Neither man knew about the other's experience. After Tom, John and the other musicians moved out and an artist moved in. Then, in 1986, Rick Williams and his wife Kathy, now deceased, looked at the house and felt drawn to it immediately. They knew John and Tom, but news of the musicians' peculiar experiences in the house had not reached them. Not that it would have mattered. The house was just what they wanted. Owner Garnet Chapin handed over the keys with one request. I'm a carpenter, so he wanted me to remodel the kitchen, says Rick. When Rick began the kitchen renovation that summer, he discovered some of his tools missing. He assumed Kathy, the only other person there, had borrowed them. Hey, did you get my saw, my hammer? Rick, I haven't touched your saw. Twice, the tools disappeared, then reappeared in the backyard, near a lady's horse mounting block. I knew I didn't do it, says Rick. I protect my tools. My dad was a house builder, and he taught me to take care of my tools. Rick didn't know an apparition fitting the description of Looney McCauley had been seen by a former resident, so he had no idea who would take such an interest in his tools. He just felt grateful they hadn't been damaged or stolen. I also had a band at the time, the Sherman Williams Band, and we'd have rehearsals there. We'd be in rehearsals in the afternoon, and the lights would come on and go off. It's an old house. I passed that off completely. We'd come home from playing, and the lights would be flickering on and off. We had turned all the lights off, and when we left, except for the back porch light, the TV would go off when you were watching a football game or something. I told Garnet, you need to check the wiring on this. And he'd tell me it had been rewired. Soon, the Williamses were introduced to the enchanting hostess who so bewitched the earlier tenants, but not face-to-face. The feminine presence manifested itself through her affection for babies and animals. I remember it like it was yesterday, said Rick. We had a pet rabbit that was supposed to be a dwarf, and it turned out to be about 16 pounds. It was a horse. So we had to keep her in a cage in the upstairs hallway. On Saturday morning, Rick explains, it was Kathy's habit to lift Emma out of the cage and bring her to the bed and let her hop around. One morning, Kathy had gone down the hall to retrieve Emma, and suddenly she let out a cry of surprise, startling Rick. What's wrong? Smell this rabbit. Kathy brought Emma into the bedroom and held it under Rick's nose. She smelled like the strongest rose perfume, he says. It was all over the rabbit's fur. It was so strong, it was pungent. It just knocked me down. No one's had perfume like that, I said. I can't stand this. It was overwhelming. Nobody was home but the two of them, Rick and Kathy. Rick asked Kathy what she'd done to the rabbit, and Kathy denied she'd done anything. For her part, Emma seemed unconcerned. We couldn't explain it, says Rick. That's when Kathy said, I think this place has a ghost. I really do. One night, friends Scott and Deb and their little daughter Ashley, about 9 months old, came for dinner. It was their first visit to the house. Scott went upstairs to the bathroom, carrying the baby. Suddenly, Ashley started cooing as if someone were playing or talking with her. She was saying, ooh, says Rick. Scott said he had this warm feeling come over him. While Scott was upstairs, Kathy told Deb about the perfumed rabbit. Scott heard nothing about it. Later, as they drove home through St. Elmo, Deb relayed the story about Emma to Scott. He ran off the road, Rick says. Afterward, Scott told Deb, I knew it. I just felt like somebody was up there. That somebody watched over the basement as well. The Williamses took in a stray German Shepherd mix named Trooper. One night, it was extremely cold, so he closed off one of the small rooms downstairs and put Trooper in it, and locked the door with a hook latch. The next morning, when Kathy scooped Emma up and brought her into the bedroom, Trooper ambled in behind them. Rick was surprised. How did you get out? He asked Trooper. Kathy, did you let Trooper out? Rick, I haven't even been downstairs. Rick went down, found the latch undone. He couldn't think of any way a dog might have unlatched the hook from the inside, and there was no other way out. Trooper enjoyed life at the house in the country. He welcomed the humans who dropped in, with one exception. If one of my friends came up with dark hair and a dark beard, he would eat him up, says Rick. He attacked one friend and tore his Levi's. Rick felt sure Trooper's last owner must have been a man with dark hair and a beard who had abused him. He knew nothing of the scowling and bearded Yankee soldier John Nichols had seen waving the saber in the side yard. Trooper may have known the soldier as well. Miss Leela could have known that Yankee soldier, too. Unknown to John and Rick, Miss Leela's father was Herman W. Grant, captain of the 4th Michigan Volunteer Cavalry at Chickamauga and Chattanooga. His regiment was actively engaged in the battles and scouting missions around North Georgia. Perhaps he saw the White House while out on sorties with his men, and like so many after him, was beckoned to return. The house continues to reach out across the years to those it seeks. Hundreds of children visit each year to meander through Rock City's adjoining enchanted maze and romp on the playground in the front field. Miss Leela still knows how to beguile the little ones entrusted to her warm and fragrant arms. And for those who do not appreciate her southern hospitality, one gruff Yankee stands ready to send them on their way.
Whether you plan to stay safe and sound at home this Halloween or brave the night in search of your own ghost stories is up to you. We hope you enjoyed this reading of Blades and Roses from Georgiana Katarsky's Ghost of the Southern Tennessee Valley. For Around and About, this is Rabbit.